Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jad Abumrad. Today on Radiolab, Robert Krulwich and I are tackling a question which is very big in neuroscience at the moment. What makes you you? Sounds actually like a childlike question, and it is, except no one really knows the answer. Before the station ID, we heard one scientist's theory that the self, or the mind, or even the soul, is nothing but a story the brain tells itself.
Listening to, what was the name of that guy?
Paul Broks.
The notion that what you are, what a self is just a story you tell, has some scientific authority behind it.
Does it? Because I actually didn't exactly know what he's talking about.
Well, V.S. Ramachandran, who's a world-famous neurologist, also believes that what is peculiarly human about us is our ability to construct stories. And he says this ability is new. Or relatively new. It happened at a particular moment in time, and he thinks he knows about when.
Maybe 200,000 years ago, 500,000 years ago, something absolutely astonishing happened.
What?
The evolution of introspective consciousness and the evolution of the self.
The evolution of introspective consciousness. What does that mean?
Well, let's do this simply and back up for a minute. There are different sets of creatures in the world. There are dumb ones, there are smarter ones, and then there's us.
Okay.
So let's just choose, say, a worm for our dumb candidate. Imagine you're a worm, you're crawling through the ground like worms like to do, and you bump into a pebble. Now here's what a worm doesn't do. A worm doesn't think, dang, I can't seem to move this pebble. Because a worm doesn't have a brain big enough or a nervous system strong enough to support the idea of dang. Me, pebble.
Certainly not dang.
There's no, I'm not a worm. But as far as V.S. Ramachandran is concerned, inside the worm's head, there is no picture at all. There's just a set of inherited instincts. No pictures in that worm's head, no story there.
Okay.
So let's step up to another level of creature. You give me a creature, but it has to be a more complex one.
Okay. How about going back to the monkey?
Okay, monkey. Monkey swinging through trees. Monkey sees a lady monkey. The lady monkey, if it has a red, how should I put this, bottom, then the lady monkey is interested in sex. So if you notice, says Dr. Ramachandran, if that rump is
red rumps of female primates.
I like the way you say red rumps.
I claim a monkey, after seeing red, can react to it. Maybe can even remember the red and do the appropriate reaction.
And the appropriate reaction in this case would be to grab that lady monkey and, you know, make a baby with her. This monkey pulls an image of another monkey in, makes an association, and so there's images in the monkey's head, but now here's something the monkey can't do.
It can't juggle the symbol red in its head.
So if I said to a monkey, see that Volvo over there, that white Volvo? Let's make it a red Volvo. Any human being can take a white car and make it in their imagination.
He can paste red on it in his imagination.
But a monkey you don't think can do.
It cannot do.
And this is so simple for a human being to do. And let's run through a quick exercise.
Okay.
Imagine for me a bird in your head. Got a bird in there?
Yeah, what kind of bird?
A canary.
Yes, now
it's
there.
Is it there? Okay.
It's there.
Make it into a brilliantly red canary, even though.
Okay, like kind of a cardinal, but canary's body, it's there.
That's right. Now make it into a striped canary.
Striped. What color stripes?
Purple.
Purple.
Purple stripes.
Purple stripes on a red canary. Okay, wait, hold up. Purple stripes on a red canary. Got it.
Is it in there now?
It's there. in all its vividglory.
Ornithological stripedness is not one of your favorites. All right, so at this moment, I'm going to point out something to you. There is no such thing as a purple-striped red canary in the world. You could search the world and never find one.
That does not surprise me.
But you've got one now in your head, however lamely. It's in there somewhere. Only a human being could do this because only humans can take images from the real world, pull them into their heads, divide them into parts, and then start turning those parts into abstractions. Monkeys, says Ramachandran, can't do that.
A monkey can be trained to think of a bird. Ring a bell and show it a bird. And the fifth time you just ring a bell, presumably it's conjuring up an image of a bird. Now, you can not only train a human to think of a bird, you can train a human to think of babies, but now the human can think of a bird's wings on a human baby, conjure an angel, which he has never seen. This is because he now has what are called tokens. He has created disembodied tokens.
So color is wings. A token, big is a token, adjectives are tokens.
Adjectives are tokens. And then he can manipulate these tokens, juxtapose them in counterintuitive ways. He can create even outlandish scenarios, what we call imagination.
Let me see if I can get this straight.
Okay.
You've got the worm who can sense the world, sort of, and then you've got the monkey who can pull the world in to some degree and make an association.
Right.
And then you've got us, and we can play with those associations.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, because of evolution. It's like we're not different from other creatures. We're just more than other creatures. And when we have these brains that have this extra, like, you know, it's like a layer on a layer cake, we can manipulate any idea at all. And we're constantly doing that. We're constantly abstracting. We are imagining so often, so thoroughly, and so well that we eventually can imagine ourselves. I can sit here looking right at you, and I can see you right now as Jad the little boy, if I want, or Jad the old dying man, if I want, or Jad with purple stripes and an elegant set of taffeta wings. The idea of self, if you think about it this way, is you take all the things that have ever happened to you, pluck from your life. If you're sad, you might pluck the sad things. If you're happy on a particular day, you might pluck the happy things. And you stitch them together into a general abstract idea. And me, then, an idea of self, is really a story that we tell ourselves. It can change from day to day. And it allows the human being to exercise that peculiarly human muscle to experience stuff and then to abstract it into a story.
Mm.
That's self.
This is Radiolab, Jad here with Robert Krulwich. So this makes more sense to me now, I think. This idea that the brain spins a story moment to moment as you're walking about, and that story is you, yourself. If it's so automatic, does it even happen when we sleep?
Why do you ask that?
Well, I asked Paul Broks this question,
mm-hmm.
and he told me something really strange. Something that made me think that maybe when we're asleep, the brain loosens its grip on the self.
Hmm.
And that the self tumbles into 1,000 parts. Or creatures, I don't know. What he told me basically is that when he was young, he would have these dreams where he'd see these things, these parts of himself, presumably. The dream would be going along fine, everything would be normal, and then all of a sudden along would come these little people.
Yes, literally little people. There were hordes of these little creatures. So I'd see the, you know, great pageants of the sweeping by, and occasionally they would come up, and I've sensed they're kind of looking at me, but then they'd go away again, and I just sort of watch.
So they were aware of you.
Well, that's a very eerie thought, because it's my brain that was producing them, as well as producing me.
That's such a strange thing. He really means little people.
Yeah, and oddly enough, he discovered he wasn't alone.
Which is why I was very fascinated by Robert Louis Stevenson, because his descriptions were very similar to the sort of things that I experienced.
Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, the author?
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important writers of the 19th century. Apparently, he saw them too.
The little people who manage man's internal theater.
That's how he describes them in one particular essay, read for us here by an actor, Joshua King. For anyone who's ever wondered, where do dreams come from? Where does an idea come from? This essay is an interesting read, and confusing. First of all, Stevenson always refers to himself in the third person, as he.
This honest fellow.
Or the dreamer.
The dreamer.
I'm not sure why. But maybe it's not so strange considering the rest of the essay is about little people in his mind. In any case, what he writes is that at first, The stories they acted out for him were, well, they didn't make any sense.
The little people played upon their stage like children, rather than like drilled actors performing a set piece to a huge hall of faces.
But over time, an interesting thing happens. Stevenson decides to become a writer.
To write and sell his tales.
And things change.
Here was he, and here were the little people who did that part of his business in quite new conditions.
Now the little people weren't just the things he saw in his dreams. They were a business opportunity. See, he was broke always and had to crank out the stories. So, very much in the spirit of the Industrial Revolution, he decides to exploit his little people, turn them into a storytelling factory. Which meant, he writes,
the stories must now be trimmed and pared and set upon all fours. They must run from a beginning to an end and fit with the laws of life. The pleasure in one word had become a business. And that not only for the dreamer, but for the little people of his theater. They understood the change as well as he.
So then what happens?
Well, he needs stories he can sell.
Mm-hmm.
So he trains his little people. This is what he writes in his essay. He trains them.
What do you mean?
Well, he had this elaborate pre-bedtime ritual. He would lie on the bed, feet off, raise one arm, close his eyes.
Raises his arm?
Yeah, it was a signal for the little people of his mind to tell him a story. And man, it better be a good one.
And behold, at once, the little people begin to bestir themselves in the same quest and labor all night long.
Places, everyone!
What he did not realize was just how good they could be.
Here is one, exactly as it came. It seemed this time that the dreamer was the son of a very rich and wicked man, the owner of broad acres and a most damnable temper. The son had been living abroad on purpose to avoid his father. When he returned, he was to find his father married again to a young wife. Because of this marriage, as the dreamer indistinctly understood, it was desirable for the father and son to have a meeting. Yet, both being proud and both angry, neither would condescend on a visit. But meet they did accordingly, in a desolate sandy country by the sea.
To the shore, please, driver.
Yes, sir. Watch your step.
And there they quarreled.
How dare you!
You selfish bastard!
And the son, stung by some intolerable insult, struck the father dead. No suspicion was aroused. The dead man was found and buried. The dreamer succeeded to the broad estates. And found himself installed under the same roof with his father's widow.
Good evening.
Madam?
Will you join me for supper?
Oh, thank you.
These two lived very much alone, as people may after a bereavement. Sat down to the table together, shared long evenings.
Brandy?
Yes, please.
And grew daily better friends.
The West Garden is so lovely this time of year.
Has that old plum tree gone to flower already?
Oh, yes. Do you recall it?
Yes, yes. I used to climb it as a boy.
Oh, really? Did your father teach you how to climb trees?
No. No, he didn't.
Until it seemed to him suddenly that she was prying about dangerous matters, that she had conceived a notion of his guilt, that she watched him and tried him with questions. So they lived at cross purposes, a life full of broken dialogue, challenging glances, and suppressed passion. Until one day, he saw the woman slipping from the house in a veil.
To the station, please.
Yes, ma'am.
He followed her by train to the seaside country, and out over the sandhills to the very place where the murder was done. There she began to grope among the bents.
Something here.
He watching her flat upon his face, and presently she had something in her hand.
This is it.
I cannot remember what it was, but it was deadly evidence against the dreamer. And as she held it up to look at it, perhaps from the shock of the discovery, a foot slipped. And she hung at some peril on the brink of the tall sand reeds.
Help me!
He had no thought but to spring up and rescue her.
Take my hand.
And there they stood, face to face. She, with that deadly matter openly in her hand. His very presence on the spot, another link of proof.
What?
It was plain she was about to speak. This was more than he could bear.
Come.
And he cut us short of the conversation.
Let's be going.
We passed the evening in the drawing room, as in the past.
Tea, madam.
Yes, please.
Sir?
Thank you.
But suspense and fear drummed in the dreamer's bosom.
Why has she not announced me yet? When will she? Will it be tomorrow?
So his thoughts ran. Once indeed, he seized an occasion when she was abroad. He ransacked her room.
Hidden it.
And at last, hidden away among her jewels, found the damning evidence.
Oh my God.
There he stood, holding this thing which was his life in the hollow of his hand, and marveling at her behavior, that she should seek and keep and yet not use it. And then the door opened, and behold, herself.
What are you doing?
Once more they stood eye to eye with the evidence between them.
No!
But before he left the room, he laid back down his death warrant where he had found it. And at that, her face lit up. The next he heard, she was lying to her maid.
Oh my goodness, what happened to your room? A robbery!
Oh no, 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 it's nothing. I'm embarrassed, really. I thought I'd lost something, you see.
Flesh and blood could bear the strain no longer, and I think it was the next morning, though chronology is always hazy in the theater of the mind, that he burst from his reserve.
Bacon, sir. No, thank you.
Your tea, madam.
Please.
Sugar?
Please.
That will be all.
And no sooner were the servants gone, and these two protagonists alone together, than he leapt to his feet. She too sprang up with a pale face.
Why have you not denounced me? You know everything. Why do you torture me?
She fell upon her knees. And with outstretched hands.
Do you not understand? I love you!
Hereupon, with a pang of wonder and mercantile delight, the dreamer awoke. But his mercantile delight was not of long endurance, as it became plain that in this spirited tale there were unmarketable elements.
Ultimately, Robert Louis Stevenson found the story unusable, and he couldn't sell it. But there's a deeper question here, a question of authorship. Let's think about it in more modern terms. When you see a movie and the lights go down, you settle in. From one moment to the next, you, the viewer, have no idea what's going to happen. You scream at the scary parts, laugh at the jokes, cry during the sad scenes. You're taken on a ride. But in order for you to have that experience, someone needed to write the movie, someone needed to direct it, someone other than you. How is it, when we dream, that we do all three at the same time? We write, direct, and watch the film as if we've never seen it before.
The little people are substantive inventors and performers. To the end, they had kept their secret. The dreamer had no guess whatever at the motive of the woman, the hinge of the whole well-invented plot, until the instant of the dramatic revelation. It was not his tale. It was the little people's. I am awake now, and I know this trade, and yet I cannot better it. The more I think of it, the more I am moved to press upon the world my question. Who are the little people?
It was almost like watching a video. You could sort of go up and inspect their activities, scrutinize their activities very closely.
That's how neurologist Paul Brox describes his little people dreams.
And it kind of fascinated me that this was part of me, part of my brain activity, but not me. So which part of my brain activity is me?
And if it seems there's a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde quality to the mystery of the little people, that is no coincidence. On another night, our dreamer Robert Louis Stevenson, once again captivated by the little people, screams so loudly his wife wakes him.
Robert, darling, wake up! What's wrong?
He was not pleased.
Damn it, woman, I had been dreaming a fine bogey tale!
But he did manage to remember a few things from the dream. One, a scene at the window. Then, a man pursued for a crime. Then that man takes a potion and undergoes a transformation. That man's name, of course, would become Mr. Hyde, and our dreamer, Robert Louis Stevenson, the author of that classic tale of a divided self. The story of Robert Louis Stevenson's Little People came from an essay from Paul Brocks from his excellent book, Into the Silent Land, and it was adapted for radio by Alan Horn. Joshua Kane was the voice of Robert Louis Stevenson from his essay, A Chapter on Dreams, and he had a supporting cast of Lorraine Maddox, John Henry Boudreau, Frank Boudreau, Nick Cappadeach, Sally Herships, and Keith Scott. And if anyone was listening closely, they would have also recognized you, Robert Crowich, on that seaside cliff.
Dying.
Yes.
Vivian! Here's the thing. What is hard to recognize if you take a look into somebody's brain and you ask the question, which we've been asking this whole hour, like, you know, who's there or where is the author or where am I? The story points up that if you look scientifically into a brain, what you encounter is hundreds of thousands of players, not just little people, but teeny brain cells, which do all this flashing back and forth. If you were to go to any one of those cells and say, so, are you the author of Jekyll and Hyde? The cell would just go...
Right. The vocabulary of a neuron is just on or off.
It is only in the group that you can see the electrical outline of a thought, or ultimately of a self. Mm. While you think of yourself as a one, even the thought, I am a one, springs from 100 million cells connecting through 1 trillion synapses, and that all of this multiple activity paradoxically creates the you of this moment. You are always plural.
And that's especially true in the story we have coming up for you in 60 seconds. This is Radio Lab. I'm Jad Abumrad. Robert Crowich and I will continue in a moment.
You're listening to Radio Lab on New York Public Radio.
Public Radio, WNYC.